From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Senate on Saturday passed, by a 50-50 vote and Vice President Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote, the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill backed by President Joe Biden. After weeks of wrangling over the details of the American Rescue Plan, including a battle to include an increase to the federal minimum wage that ultimately failed, the bill did pass and now heads to the House for a Tuesday vote. While many are hailing it as the largest expansion of government anti-poverty efforts in a generation, progressives feel the bill did not go far enough, considering the nation's crippling inequality. My guest is Joe Dinkin, Working Families Party National Communications Director. Welcome to the program, Joe.
Thanks again for having me, Sonali. I'm happy to be here.
So let's first talk about the battle over the $15 an hour minimum wage, which seems to be a symbol of what Democrats are willing to do, how they could fail, you know, in a way that sort of implies that they themselves haven't been able to go far enough. Was that battle, which ultimately failed, to you a troubling indication of the party's future?
I think it is troubling. I want to say a couple of things about the relief bill passed in the Senate this past weekend. In some measure, it is pretty remarkable as a success in how progressives have changed the window of the possible. The Senate managed to pass a $1.9 trillion bill that puts money in the pockets of working people through cash relief, through childcare, through a number of other important measures, state and local funding, and without any kind of the major giveaways to corporations or tax cuts that you often see in these big packages. And so in some measure, it's really a remarkable achievement that a $1.9 trillion package really dedicated wholly to things that benefit working class and middle class people. On the other hand, there are some troubling signs in the politics of what happened. And, you know, with Democrats in power, Democrats are accountable to lead and the people expect them to lead. And so when popular measures get excluded or cut, it tells voters sometimes that Democrats don't have the ability or the willingness to do those things. And I think the $15 minimum wage is a perfect example. It's not the only example, too. Democrats ended up negotiating with themselves over cutting the expanded unemployment that was in the original version of the bill. It was going to be an added $400 a week continuing on extended unemployment benefits, and the timeline got shrank and it got restricted from an additional $400 to an additional $300. The minimum wage, the $15 minimum wage, an overwhelmingly popular policy, including popular in purple, red, and blue states alike, was cut out of the final package. And there was this ongoing dispute over whether or not to further restrict the cash relief. And the cash relief was further restricted slightly, got about 12 million people who might have gotten checks during the last relief package cut out of it. And all told, I think there are many valuable things that are passed out of this bill and relief that people need. But when we look at the scale of crisis that voters have lived through over the last 2 years, Democrats are going to need to do a lot more, and they're going to need to figure out how to pass things with 50 votes rather than, you know, a reconciliation package like this bill was done can pass with 50 votes, but by simultaneously saying that minimum wage is not subject to reconciliation, but rather needs 60 votes, and that reforming the filibuster is essentially not on the table. It really like puts for me the onus on leaders in both chambers and in the White House to tell us how they're not why they can't pass a $15 minimum wage, but how they're going to deliver it. Right. And with Democrats holding both chambers, if they don't manage to do so, voters will have nobody to blame for that. But Democrats being unable to get it together to do so. So for the sake of the many, many millions of working class families that desperately need an increase in the minimum wage that hasn't risen and more than a decade, I really hope that they can figure it out.
Let's talk about, and I want to get to the filibuster, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, and all of these folks. But let's talk about what is in the bill. Because if you read the corporate media, this is the greatest anti-poverty program in a generation. It's the biggest expansion. It's an anti-austerity measures. Many have hailed the child tax credits that have passed. Even though the unemployment, weekly unemployment benefits were reduced from, I believe it was 400 to 300 a week, which is nearly not enough. And even though the $15 an hour raise was not included, what was included in that progressives should hail as important?
Yeah, I think the cash relief going out to the overwhelming majority of Americans is a big deal. I
These were the
think that,
stimulus checks that the
yeah,
eligibility was
that
also
should have been
narrowed. That
bigger,
was another issue.
should have been bigger, should be recurring for on the scale of how long people have been in crisis. But their passage still is a lot of money in the pockets of working class and middle class families. I think that the child tax credit that people talk about, the expanded child credit, is a kind of under-noticed provision that will, in fact, put lots of money in the pockets of working class and middle class families with kids. And while it's temporary right now, expansions of benefits like that are sometimes hard to claw back after they're created. And so we think there is a chance that they could be extended. The ongoing unemployment is sort of a partway win. It wasn't expanded the way that we wanted, but at the same time, the added unemployment benefits continue forward in a way that, had we not won in Georgia, Democrats probably would not have been able to, if Democrats hadn't won control of the Senate, we would have ended up with Republicans probably blocking the extended unemployment insurance much more severely. And then the funding for state and local aid is going to be a huge relief to municipalities that are seeing the specter of budget cuts in at the local and state level. The municipalities and states don't have the ability to borrow the same way that the federal government does. And so preventing state governments from ending up cutting school, funding for education, funding for healthcare, public employees' pensions during this crisis, I think is a relief. That said, like you said, there's also some major items
I want to
that
just focus on the child tax credit for a minute because I don't know if it's gotten enough attention. In one New York Times article about it, it says, though framed in technocratic terms as an expansion of an existing tax credit, it is essentially a guaranteed income for families with children, akin to children's allowances that are common in other rich countries. And then Lisa Featherstone, writing in Jacobin magazine about the entire child tax credits part of the bill, also explained that this is notable because the child tax credit expansion is something that has happened for the first time in the 24-year history of the credit. The money is going to be offered even to people with no taxable income, which is quite significant. And as you said, it's the kind of thing that once it is in place, it becomes easier to extend it, which Democrats don't often enough take advantage of. So this seems to be a very significant thing for families with children, at least.
I think that's right. And what's so interesting to observe is how much a rising progressive movement has succeeded in changing the arguments at the heart of Democratic Party politics. It wasn't that long ago, 20 something years ago, that Bill Clinton was, declaring the end of welfare as we know it. This is with no strings or work requirements attached in sort of old neoliberal democratic model. This is cat in the hands of poor and working class and middle class families to help cover the high cost of raising children. And it's guaranteed as of right. It's not as you say, it's guaranteed whether or not you owe taxes. So in the same way that the earned income tax credit is a revenue positive, and it's actually people are going to experience it as cash that they receive directly rather than showing up in a complicated formula on their taxes.
So that is pretty significant. And it's interesting because, at least as a journalist covering this bill before it passed, it wasn't an issue that was very focused on, and maybe it benefited from the lack of focus by being included in this massive bill and getting passed, because often a lot of these battles turn into culture wars. Let's talk about the opposition that the minimum wage increase received from seven Democrats and one independent who caucuses with Democrats. I mean, obviously, we expected all 50 Republicans to oppose it, but for so many Democrats and Angus King to oppose this is an indication of the challenge for other issues to come when addressing inequality, right? I mean, Kyrsten Sinema, who is such an interesting case in point, there was an interesting piece by David Sirota about her that pointed out that she was once a leader in the Green Party. She was so progressive that she was known as an icon in a third party. And now her famous thumbs down for the minimum wage raise has earned her the ire of progressives. Why are these Democrats literally voting against their own party's interests? I mean, Biden won Arizona, Kyrsten Sinema's state.
Sure. I think it's a really good question. And it just goes to show that there's more organizing that needs to be done, and that, you know, politicians are not permanent friends or permanent enemies. They're the targets that we have to move the people behind them, or move the people to move the politicians. And so, you know, there are big organizing efforts underway in all of those states, so that the senators hear from and feel accountable to the voters that so desperately need a minimum wage increase. I think it is really also a challenge that's going to require the leaders of the Democratic Party, who have committed to this goal of a $15 minimum wage, to exert muscle to help bring the entire caucus along.
Let's also now talk about the issue of the filibuster. Senator Tina Smith, who's a Democrat, in a lengthy Facebook post explained how she started as a supporter of this tactic because, you know, in theory, the filibuster is meant to, or we think of it in idealistic terms as something that encourages debate, encourages two parties to come to a consensus by requiring 60 votes, and that an actual filibuster takes the form of senators having endless discussions. But in fact, all that ends up happening, according to Senator Tina Smith, who has now evolved on this issue, is that they threaten the filibuster and then go home to dinner, and one party can simply hold the other party hostage. She has evolved on the filibuster, and now we're hearing that Joe Manchin might consider exempting certain bills from being held hostage to the filibuster. But I mean, he is the one, right, who's holding, these Democratic Party bread and butter issues hostage.
You know, I think you have to start with an understanding that the Senate itself is an anti-democratic institution. Mm-hmm. It biases small states, rural states, and overwhelmingly white states. It's just worth noting that even though the Senate is deadlocked at 50-50, the Democratic caucus in the Senate represents 40 million more people than the Republican caucus in the Senate. So even just having to win Democrats based on the current coalitions that make up the two big parties, even just having to win a majority requires for Democrats a much broader level of public support, popular support, winning over more of the voters in America than it does for Republicans. Adding the 60 vote threshold on top of it makes a lot of different kinds of legislation almost totally off the table. And I think that's an unacceptable option, whether what you care about is climate change or voting rights or the minimum wage. It's just unacceptable to say that we can never do those things until there are 60 Senate votes, because 60 Senate votes is not just requiring a supermajority, it's requiring an overwhelming supermajority of voters in the country to be electing just to get to 60 Democrats. Frankly, I think that the Senate as a whole is a huge constraint on the ability of progressives to pass policy. Understanding that, we actually have a very narrow window to, you know, solve the massive crises that people expect us to solve. And with Democrats in power, we think it's imperative that they do so.
Right, you're talking about the 2022 midterms, where traditionally the party in power, especially one that controls all three branches of government, will lose some power in the midterms that follow. Democrats cannot afford to lose even a single Senate seat, and certainly no more than a handful of House seats. You write in a piece that you just authored about the fight over the COVID relief bill that the choice for Democrats in Congress is to go big or go home. Now, let's take Senator Joe Manchin. He's a representative of West Virginia. And the assumption is that he votes the way he does. He basically votes like a Republican. I mean, the only benefit he really offers the Democratic Party is that they get to have committee chairs and majorities on committees. But the assumption is that he would lose re-election in West Virginia if he supported some of these progressive Democratic Party proposals. But is that really true, especially of issues that involve lifting America's poor up?
Look, our polling found 63% of West Virginia voters supporting a $15 minimum wage.
Wow.
It's a popular idea all across America. I mean, if you look at Florida in the 2020 elections, Joe Biden lost Florida by a couple of points on the same day, on the same ballot. An amendment to raise the state minimum wage in Florida to $15 an hour passed with 60% of the vote. So we know that raising the minimum wage is popular among voters. But I think that the idea that Republicans are going to come to the table to negotiate is a fantasy and belies everything that we've learned over the last 8 years or over the last 12 years or more. It is in the interest of the Republicans to have the economy still be pretty bad for most working people in 2022. That will allow them to say to American voters, you put Democrats in charge, are things getting better for you? And if the answer isn't absolutely clear, that's what creates the familiar pattern of the party in power losing seats in the midterm. I think the way for Democrats to overcome and avoid that is Democrats have to go big. If Democrats go big, imagine a world in 2022 where unemployment has dropped to a tiny number, where COVID is nothing but a terrible memory, where wages are going up, where millions of jobs are being created in care and in transforming our climate, and where voters know that it's the Democrats that did that. I think that's the situation in which Democrats have the best chance to overcome the normal political gravity of the midterm reaction. If voters know that it's their basic economic security is getting better, and it's the Democrats who did that for them. But that's the responsibility of the Democrats to go big, because Republicans will profit if they manage to stall action on important provisions.
So if Joe Manchin refuses to do the right thing, even when it is popular in his own state, is the step then for progressives to primary these Senate Democrats and honestly, even any House Democrats that are not willing to go far enough to back popular measures that help struggling Americans? We've seen in the House that has been a fairly good strategy. We saw that a populist left, the populist left ideas helped Georgia Senators Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff win their races in this past January. Is it time to start talking about primarying these Senate Democrats?
I think in the immediate, the most important thing is for those senators to hear from voters in their own states about what life is really like having come through the catastrophic year of 2020. We need to have voters en masse telling their own stories of the lives they've lived, struggling through some of the hardest times a lot of people have ever struggled through without, in our country in generations, often, losing jobs, losing income, losing their homes. And I think those senators need to hear directly from their voters, and they need to listen to them. To me, that's the most important.
Do you think that the next bill that Democrats are eyeing, which of course, given the difficulty of passing this COVID relief bill, will make the next one more difficult, but that one focuses on, at least right now what we're hearing is that Democrats are interested in passing a large infrastructure bill. And of course, we still have the For the People Act, which is the massive overhaul of a federal overhaul of voting rights, which is really important to help hold on to power in the next round of elections, because we know Republicans played dirty and essentially went through undemocratic means. But in the infrastructure bill, there's now talk of you know, senators like Bernie Sanders backing recurring payments to Americans until the pandemic is over, while of course at the same time being an important jobs program to help improve our crumbling infrastructure. Is that a good focus for the left going forward?
Yeah, I think that the jobs the jobs and recovery package is a hugely important opportunity for the left to engage on. You know, we at the Working Families Party are supporting a vision called the Thrive Agenda, which would invest $1 trillion in every year for the next 10 years in creating and maintaining 16 million new jobs, primarily in transitioning our energy sector to clean energy, in care jobs, in you know, addressing the shortage in nursing care and child care and elder care that we need, and in which are also, by the way, clean climate jobs, jobs that are really needed and also don't have a big carbon footprint, and also investing in repair for the frontline communities, mainly communities of color, that have suffered the worst impacts of current dirty energy economy through problems like asthma and other forms of environmental pollution in their neighborhoods. So we think there's an opportunity to go very big and very ambitious, and it is our hope that Democrats take up that opportunity, and they'll be hearing from us about that right now.
And I imagine that too is the kind of thing that is very likely popular with Americans. I mean, we just saw the Texas energy grid fail in the extreme winter weather. Americans largely now agree that climate change is real. They need jobs. It seems a no-brainer.
Yeah, I think it's an overwhelmingly popular proposal. And for us, the task will be to be mobilized enough that we create the inevitability that that's the plan for Democrats to take up.
And then finally, the House on Tuesday is expected to vote on the bill. They already passed a version of the bill, but the version that they passed included the minimum wage increase. And I imagine that the Senate version of the bill that passed on Saturday is different enough from the House version that they have to pass it separately again. And then it is expected to be signed into law by Joe Biden. Do you think that Biden in his, you know, because one of the problems that Democrats often have is they don't sell their party very well to voters. They don't sell their achievements very well to voters. And I think part of that is that they're constantly trying to toe a line between pleasing Wall Street and pleasing their base. But if they literally chose to please their base and shouted it from the mountaintops that this was an achievement, modest as it was, it could have a big impact on popular perception and therefore the party and the nation's future, right?
Yeah, I think absolutely Democrats should do everything they can to take a victory lap on the $1.9 trillion plan, but also to tell us where it's going from here, and to show the scope of their ambition, show accomplishment, and generate some momentum for continuing to win the kind of policies that will really lift up working class people, and help us recover from this year of crisis in 2020.
And by the way, just to mention the Republicans in the Senate, Roy Blunt of Missouri just announced that he would not be running for re-election. He becomes a fifth senator, including Richard Burr and Pat Toomey, Rob Portman and Richard Shelby, to announce their retirement. There was an interesting interview that Lindsey Graham did, of course, top-ranking senator, with Axios reporter Jonathan Swan, where he all but said that the party was being held hostage by Donald Trump. And it seems as though Republicans are saying rather than choose the pariah status of Mitt Romney and speaking out against Trump, they're either going along with Trump, even if they disagree with him, like Graham, or simply retiring. But these do represent openings for the Democratic Party in the Senate, right?
I think they do. And I think it speaks to how badly broken our two-party system is, that one party can be held so totally captive to a white nationalist base like that. I think that that's really a shameful event in our nation. And I do think that the retirement of Senate Republicans shows that the normal partisan trajectory of a bounce back in the midterms towards Republicans is not inevitable. I think Republicans also think it's not inevitable, but I think that for Democrats to realize that opportunity, they've got to lead with ambition and vision. They've got to win on things like the relief package, which they just did. But even after the $1,400 checks dry up, they're going to need to be explaining how they are going to recover from a year of historic crisis from not just COVID, but also the economic recession caused by it that's left, many families in much more precarious financial situation than they were before, how to deal with the, growing and undeniable crisis around climate change, how to tackle racial justice. And I think if Democrats put forward that vision, there is an opportunity for them to continue to gain ground if they go big.
Joe, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website for Working Families Party.
Yeah, please join Working Families at www.workingfamilies.org or just text member to 30403 and get connected up with us that way. You can just text member to 30403.
Thank you so much, Joe, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your time. Always happy to be here.
My guest, Joe Dinkin, is with Working Families Party, and we've been discussing the COVID relief bill that the Senate just passed. The House will vote on and likely pass that bill on Tuesday, after which it is expected to be signed into law by President Joe Biden. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.